Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I am your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing the International Criminal Court inquiry or preliminary investigation of Boko Haram in Nigeria. I'm joined by a special guest, Otto Traudy. Otto is an international lawyer and former prosecutor at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, where he litigated cases that involved charges of genocide, crimes against humanity, and violations of the laws of armed conflict. Otto has also made submission and representation at several of the courts, including the International Criminal Court, also including the US Supreme Court, European Court of Human Rights and Justice, and also served at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Otto, you've got quite a long, extensive experience in your field, and I'm very, very grateful to have you today and look forward to our conversation.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here, and I am grateful to you and to Conflict and Development in Africa and to the Center for African Justice for making this happen.
You're welcome. So I was reading your chapter that you contributed to a very important book on contemporary international law, particularly when it relates to Africa, and it's quite an interesting chapter. And I wanted to start off from there. So in 2010, the International Criminal Court, ICC, opened an inquiry into Boko Haram in Nigeria. And that inquiry took 10 years, roughly, to finish. So I wanted to ask you to start off by telling us why that inquiry was initiated, what is the scope of the inquiry, and what is the state of the inquiry at this moment?
That's a great set of questions to start off with. So first, let me start with a procedural note. And I know this is a technicality to start with when the substance is really important, but it's important to understanding the answer to your question, which is that an international criminal court process is going to go through two primary stages before you get to a particular individual being charged with a crime with a jurisdiction of the court and the possibility of a trial. Mm-hmm. The first stage is called a preliminary examination. And in that stage, basically, the Office of the Prosecutor isn't going out and collecting material itself. Mm-hmm. What it's doing is saying, okay, there's information about lots of conflicts in the world out there. There are people collecting evidence and sending it to us. On the basis of that information that we've received from others or that's been published that's open source, Are there reasonable grounds to believe that crimes within our jurisdiction have been committed? Mm-hmm. And that cases against people responsible for those crimes would be admissible in front of the court, in the sense that first, they're serious enough to merit the court's exercise of jurisdiction. And here, the term the court uses is that they satisfy the gravity standard. And second, that they're not being dealt with by domestic authorities already, because the court is a court of complementarity. And so if a national court and the ICC both want to prosecute the same person for the same conduct, the national court gets the priority. So ICC goes through several stages in its process, to the office the prosecutor does, in deciding whether to move towards an investigation, which is the second stage of the process, where they may go out and collect evidence themselves more actively, and a stage that's necessary to reach before any particular individual is charged. And here, the situation in Nigeria, as they frame it, focuses significantly, though not exclusively, on alleged crimes by Boko Haram, its members, and other related groups like Ansaru. It took about 3 years, I think, 2010 to 2013, for the Office of the Prosecutor to say, okay, we've decided that crimes within our jurisdiction have been committed. And for a lot, it appears, of the period between 2013 and 2020, what their reports indicate they were doing, rather than moving forward to an investigation, was communicating with domestic authorities in Nigeria, looking at any cases that Nigeria was doing against Boko Haram members, and seeing if that second criteria, complementarity, meant that the ICC should stand down because the Nigerian authorities were standing up, essentially, and doing the cases themselves. Now, that said, you know, I think that's the explanation that the court would give. That said, you asked why this has taken 10 years, and now it's 14, of course, and we're still not at an investigation stage. And I think that's a really hard question. There aren't a lot of preliminary examinations in the history of the court that have gone on for that long. And there are risks. And one of the things that I think occurs to me is that the Office of the Prosecutor is likely in a difficult position now. That, take, for example, the most notorious crime committed in Nigeria in the conflict, the kidnapping of almost 300 young women from the Chibok school about 10 years ago, almost 100 of whom are still missing. It'd be really hard at this point for the Office of the Prosecutor to start investigating it itself from zero. You know, it wouldn't have access to an undisturbed crime site. Some victims would have passed away. Many of the people who were proximate witnesses would have either passed away or their memories would have faded over the course of 10 years. The leader of Boko Haram at the time, Abubakar Shekau, has reportedly died since. And so the person that you would be most interested in figuring out if they're the real architect of this very serious crime is no longer available to you as a prosecutor. At the same time, if we look at their statements up to last week, they've been unwilling to say, we stand behind the cases that the Nigerians are doing. Those are good enough, and we're going to stand down out of complementarity. In fact, Fatou Bensouda in December 2020 said none of the cases the Nigerians are doing relate even indirectly to the cases that ICC would do if it opened an investigation. And so what I would expect is that at this point, the Office of the Prosecutor has a hard time moving forward, particularly on the earlier crimes in the situation, because of the passage of time. Not an impossible time moving forward, but a hard time. That it doesn't, we've seen in the past, want to defer completely to the Nigerian justice process in this specific situation for its own reasons. And because the crimes are so serious, it doesn't want to just throw its hands up and give up, because what you have here are allegations that, by the standards of the other cases the International Criminal Court has done, are very serious crimes, assuming proven. So there aren't necessarily a lot of good options for them at this stage. And it's possible that they've gotten stuck in this complementarity analysis for too long, and it's limited their options. Now, we saw one way out last week when the deputy prosecutor, Niang, went to Nigeria and essentially took a much more positive line on the Nigerian authorities' own prosecutions. And I have the quote here. I'm just going to read it. So he said two things that stuck out to me. First, I welcome the expression of willingness and ability by the Nigerian authorities to take their full responsibility as regards the alleged criminal conduct the office, meaning the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, has identified. And willing and able are terms that refer to the complementarity language in the Rome Statute. So this is these are words that are carefully selected to indicate that the court can stand down if the Nigerian authorities stand up and do these cases. And the other thing he said that I thought was really interesting, the words he used were, we'll give complementarity a chance in Nigeria. And this, on the one hand, is of course exactly what the court is supposed to do under the Rome Statute, right? Unlike the ad hoc tribunals where I worked, it's not a court of primacy. It's a court that you can imagine why the states who created it and signed on to the Rome Statute would want this. It's a court that's supposed to let those states go first. It's a court that is supposed to defer to states and give them primacy in dealing with these crimes when they're willing and able to do so. At the same time, you know, typically when you say, we'll give this process a chance, you're relatively early in that process. When you say, we'll give complementarity a chance in Nigeria after 14 years of, you know, purportedly communicating with the domestic authorities there, and for much of that time saying that you weren't satisfied, having the previous prosecutor say, they're simply not doing the cases we'd be interested in, it's a really interesting word choice, I think, and suggests, I'm not sure exactly what, but
I'm going to pull up on that. So when, so I've seen some snippet of Fatou Bensouda's, conclusion, but if I follow up on what you said and why in the last 10 years or 11 years, where ICC has been trying to, you know, back and forth complementarity, and all of a sudden, do you think that the change in tone now from the deputy prosecutor compared to Fatou Bensouda's position, do you think it has to do with ICC's own survival on the continent? Because we've seen where countries like South Africa, you know, Burundi, and some other countries have tried to withdraw from ICC, and Nigeria have staunchly, you know, supported ICC. Do you think that there's some kind of like, you know, is that present?
Stuff going on behind the scenes here that might be affecting the process? Yeah, look, I think that's possible. That's not something that I have evidence of from what's out there in the public. But I think you make a really important point, and it's one I make in the chapter too, that during the controversies, let's say, about the court in Africa, Nigeria has been a strong supporter for much of the time that the preliminary examination was ongoing. A Nigerian judge, one of my former colleagues at the Rwandan tribunal, Chile Ebo Osuji, was the president of the International Criminal Court. And, you know, coincidentally, at the same time, Nigeria was a strong supporter of the court's work, even when in the African Union, the court was a little bit controversial. And Nigeria, in part, I think, because every state would, well, not every, many states would rather do cases themselves. And in part because the ICC's situation in Nigeria also involves some allegations against Nigerian government forces. Nigeria, I think, took a much more critical tone after Prosecutor Bensouda announced that there was enough material to move forward with an investigation. And where we sat for about 39 months, I think, as far as I could tell anyway, up to the deputy prosecutor's statement last week, was we sat in limbo. Because, you know, she'd said that the standards are met legally. I have enough to go forwards to an investigation stage, which can lead to charges against either Boko Haram members or members of other groups that have committed international crimes in the context of the situation. But I'm not prioritizing it. I'm going to leave whether to go forward with it up to the next prosecutor, the current prosecutor, Karim Khan, who was installed about 6 months later. He has not been as vocal on Nigeria as on some other conflicts. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that while in 2014, the international crimes that were committed against one particular group of Nigerian victims really captured the attention of the world for a brief time, it has not been one of the situations that, you know, the NGOs who lobby the office of the prosecutor focus on this, focus on that. Nigeria hasn't been one of their priorities. When I looked at it, there wasn't a ton of scholarship on it. And so I don't know that from the meetings they go to, the conferences that they go to, I don't know that the office of the prosecutor is hearing, you know, this is a situation where you have to act either.
That's quite interesting. So if we look at before we come to I think this also points to what we have in international, the responsibility to protect. When they say the international community has responsibility to protect, which I think ICC falls under, you know, that kind of category. And then sovereignty, how do you bridge? Because the, like Riley said, primacy, the primary responsibility of protecting and, you know, prosecuting lies with the state. But when the state itself becomes the perpetrator in this case, where because myself, I'm a researcher, Boko Haram. I'm like an expert of Boko Haram. We've published extensively on it, and where we've seen where the state forces have committed crimes as well. So when you're in that position, how does ICC, I think that dilemma, how does ICC bridge from past experience? How do they bridge? How do they resolve that dilemma?
Yeah, I think that's a good set of questions. And you're right to cite your own expertise on Boko Haram. You're much more of an expert on the group than I am. And so I'll be really interested in what you think of the factual findings that the court's been able to make at this early stage of this of its investigation. But in terms of the balance between the responsibility to protect and sovereignty, I guess I'd say a couple of things. The first is that, you know, the International Criminal Court is not a universal institution, and the states that have joined it have done so voluntarily. Now, you know, there are some states, particularly in Europe, who strongly encourage other states to join, right? And certainly there are plenty of NGOs who encourage states to join. But nobody's been forced to do that. And to the extent that the court is exercising jurisdiction in the territory of a state that's signed on voluntarily, or against the nationals of a state that's signed on voluntarily, you know, I think that's consistent with that state's treaty obligations. And so I'm not sure there's too much of a sovereignty issue in those cases. Where a defendant is a national or particularly a government official of a state who hasn't signed on to the court, then I think you have a much larger kind of sovereignty challenge and a thornier both philosophical and legal question as a result. In terms of responsibility to protect, I think, to me, my bottom line on that in the context of the law is, look, this is downstream protection. Right. You're dealing in the context of at least crimes have already been committed. Very serious crimes have already been committed. You look at the ICC's preliminary examination reports on Nigeria, and they're finding, you know, 10,000 civilians have been killed, more than that by the time it gets to the end of the process. And that's just what they're able to find on the ability, on the basis of the information that's come into them. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to create unreasonable expectations for what a court that doesn't have an army, doesn't have a police force, can mm-hmm. do in terms of protecting people. But I think to the extent that we hope that the possibility of prosecutions will play a role in deterring crimes and incapacitating mm. people who have started committing them before they can commit more of them. You know, of course, a 15-year preliminary examination is just really hard to square with that goal of protecting the people who are involved, right? And, you know, they're prosecutors. They can't just say, we have people being hurt, we need to step in. They need to have evidence that meets a certain legal standard. But we do know in 2020 that they had decided they had enough evidence to move forward, and they didn't. And that had occurred after several years of waiting on this complementarity process. So I think in this case, it's a reminder that for a variety of reasons, for the effectiveness of some of the cases, but also for the protection of people who might be harmed if crimes continue, decisiveness is important.
Yeah. I'll come back to the utility of ICC and where they've established jurisdiction, and then they're kind of like hamstrung with things of complementarities. But let me go. When I read your chapter, it looks like I'm getting a sense that you're really asking for ICC to cede authority or yield to the Nigerian state. But so I wanted to ask you, are you saying this, correct me if I'm wrong, but are you saying this on the basis of the Nigerian state having that sovereignty? Are you saying it on the basis of what they've done so far in terms of the cases they've prosecuted, the number of, you know, how transparent they are? What was this based on?
So I think I'll say a couple of things. I'm not sure I would put it quite as strongly as asking them to cede to the Nigerian state, though if you look at the independent expert review that was done of the court's functioning about 5 years ago, they advocate, and I have a lot of sympathy for this, what I think, where I come from, we'd call it go hard or go home approach to ICC investigations. Don't do so many of them. Don't spend 14 years in the preliminary examination process. Focus on the ones where the most serious allegations are, and, you know, get in there, really do some cases, do them professionally, and get some convictions. At this point, though, I think it's the ICC's approach, at least as of up to last week. You know, maybe now they'll say positive complementarity has worked and suddenly we're satisfied with the Nigerian process. But at least up to last week, they weren't doing cases themselves, and the Nigerian authorities were doing some. And look, you know, part of my background is as a prosecutor of this sort of crime. And I'm inclined to respect the people who are actually starting to do the work. And second, you know, they weren't showing results or moving forward. It was just, I think, very difficult to justify a limbo kind of situation for a situation that, look, you know, I came to this as somebody who's prosecuted similar types of cases and who was looking at the International Criminal Court, because I teach and I write and I do research, and thinking about, so what kind of crimes is it really looking at? And what's the most serious stuff that it's handled? Because it gets criticized sometimes fairly, sometimes unfairly, for its case selection on a bunch of different grounds. And I looked at it, and I was really surprised to find that based on the court's own gravity standards, you know, what it was saying was happening in Nigeria was some of the most serious things that it had under its jurisdiction. And that it was, despite that, very few people were writing about them. Very few people were talking about them. They weren't a primary part of the discourse around the ICC, which focuses on, you know, Afghanistan and Ukraine and other situations. And the Office of the Prosecutor itself was also not particularly prioritizing them at the time. And, you know, this would have been 3 or 4 years ago when I started looking into it, though I don't think it's changed. If anything, other situations have gotten more prominent. And so I think what I come to it as, if I was calling for something, it's let's get a situation where cases like this are being done professionally. And I'm less concerned with whether the Nigerians are doing it or the International Criminal Court is. Of course, it's true that the ICC is, you know, this is something that you have to be in one of the International Criminal Court building or International Tribunal buildings to internalize, but there's only a couple of courtrooms. And the ICC has jurisdiction over like 24 situations, some more serious than Nigeria, some less serious. But it's never going to do, you know, there's a mass trial of alleged Boko Haram members that dealt with 600 defendants or something like that. ICC is never going to do 600 cases in a given situation. And the largest number of people they've charged in any single situation is about 5. And the most common number, I believe, is still 0. And so the Nigerian authorities, if we're going to get justice as relates to the great majority of people who've been in some way involved in these crimes, right? Because it took far more than 5 people just to kidnap that bunch of young women from Chibok, let alone all the other crimes that ICC includes in its investigation. If we're going to have justice for the great majority of those people, it would have to happen in Nigeria, in Nigerian courts. And Nigeria and its justice system would have to be supported in a variety of ways in doing that. And that can take a bunch of different forms, whether it's other states sharing evidence that they have about the group and its functioning or cooperating in actually apprehending, getting custody of perpetrators so they can be brought to trial, whatever type of assistance is most necessary in the given circumstances. But a lot of the work, if it's gonna be done at all, will inevitably have to be done in Nigerian courts.
I get a point. I get several things come up from what you've just your answer now. So I think one of the things that's come up for me is the ICC, to some extent, is selective in the cases it prosecutes, but it's not also necessarily, this is what I'm getting, it's not also necessarily that it has some form of ulterior motive. It might be limited by resources. So if it's limited by resources, then it has to be pragmatic in terms of, you know, pick up the most egregious cases, and you know, and then how they decide that will also be an important question to ask. How do they decide which case is? Do they go by quantity? Do they go by gravity? Do they go by how do they decide and define what cases to focus on and what cases to?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think they have to, as the limbo of the Nigeria situation reflects, it's not just cases that they have to distinguish. And when I say cases, I mean the prosecution of an individual or a group of individuals for a crime. But it's also situations, because, and by that I mean the collection of potential cases in a given country. Right? Because before you get to, like, here are the people that might be charged in relation to the Chibok kidnapping, you have to start looking into Boko Haram and trying to understand that group and understand how the people in charge of it, things that you've researched, I'm sure, that the court has perhaps not collected direct evidence about yet. How do the people in charge of that group assert authority over lower level members who would actually go out and do something, right? So you do an investigation into the full situation, and then the court thinks about, okay, who's most responsible for crimes, and what crimes are gravest in terms of being the most serious. And in terms of most responsible, you know, often, though not always, this will coincide with people in higher level positions, people that the court views as the architect of the crime. If assuming they're able to prove that. So if you imagine, you know, a unit goes out into the field and massacres 20 people, and it was ordered to do so by its commander, who was ordered to do so by his commander, who was acting on the basis of a policy set at a higher level to go out and massacre civilians, then in some sense, the person most responsible for the variety of civilian massacres that were carried out pursuant to that policy is the person who made that policy, right? They're the architect of the crime. And so that in a general sense, is one of the biggest priorities of international courts, is finding that architect. In terms of gravity, the other things that the courts look at are, for instance, you know, how many people are harmed by a particular crime or harmed in a particular situation? How bad is the crime in its nature? So for instance, is the crime murder, which kills somebody? Is the crime rape, which imposes a unique type of harm on a living victim, a surviving victim? Is the crime motivated by discriminatory intent? So for instance, persecution is a crime against humanity or genocide in that it targets groups. How broad is it? How many of them are contained within the situation? Is it something that lasts? So for instance, the 100 or so, almost 100 young women kidnapped from Chibok who are still missing, you know, they've been victims of a crime probably continually for those 10 years. Which makes it more serious than if they'd been released the next day, because they've been just commonsensically, they've continued to be victimized. And that's worse than if they were victimized more briefly. Still, you know, for the ones who were victimized more briefly, still terrible. I'm not seeking to diminish that, just, you know, it's worse if it happens for longer. So the court looks at factors like that. And those have guided, to some extent, case selection and prioritization. One of the things that you've seen at other international courts too, I think, is that some choices are made practically, you know, what defendants are potentially available that that can be brought in for trial. The International Criminal Court has done to this point a pretty small number of cases against individuals. It has, I think, about half a dozen core crimes convictions, the great majority on cases out of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that limits, to some extent, our ability to draw conclusions about its own case selection and prioritization. But they say they look at some of these same factors that they use to assess the gravity of a given crime in deciding what to prioritize, which in principle anyway seems to make sense. You want to try to do the worst stuff first.
I agree with that. To be honest with you, I don't think I've got too much criticism for that approach. But I think I want to ask this question in three different layers. So if I look at that strategy, which looks more practical to me, like the way to go, let's focus on the architect, like I said. But for these kind of cases, for these kind of groups like Boko Haram or Al-Qaeda or ISIS, we've also seen where they don't have that, you know, standard conventional structure where you have, you know, all of that kind of, they're quite decentralized. And we've also seen with the you know, American Western approach, counterterrorism, where maybe it's a drone attack to take out a particular leader, and the next minute there's a new leader, and it's not have effect. So I'm looking at how that approach in itself could is there an effective approach? That's one layer. The second layer is if the international criminal court is that limited, how about trying regional courts? Because I know we had international criminal on Rwanda. Maybe it could be, you know, or even we could have non-specialist court like ECOWAS court, where, you know, these cases can take over. How do we utilize those courts?
Yeah, I think you see a couple of different examples of utilization of those courts on the African continent, for instance, in African-led processes. The Extraordinary African Chambers in Senegal that dealt with the Hissène Habré case, for instance, and the discussion anyway of an ECOWAS-based court for transitional justice related to the Gambia and to allegations against members of the Jammeh regime. Mm-hmm. So I think that's right and important. I don't necessarily seek to prescribe what would be the best solution in this case or anything like that. I think ICTR, which did far more cases than ICC has done and was dealing with only the one situation, still you were looking at dozens rather than hundreds or thousands of potential defendants. And so Nigeria has a big job. And in that instance, too, Rwanda did large numbers, thousands and thousands and thousands of cases in the Gacaca courts involving genocide suspects, genocide defendants who were not deemed senior level enough to get sent to ICTR.
Mm. That could come to some of the things that we've been talking about now. If it's a dilemma where you want to provide justice for the victims of these crimes, and then you're looking at the sheer number of perpetrators and the resources, and also being able to differentiate between hardcore people or people that were being coerced into perpetrating violence. So should we be looking at the transitional court you mentioned in Senegal, look at the transitional justice or truth reconciliation in South Africa, or you want to look at what's even going on in Nigeria itself with Operation Safe Corridor, with right. But some people have looked at this and said, one, and I think that's what Ben Suda's stuff highlighted as well, that the cases in Nigeria are not dealing with the more serious cases. That's number one. Number two, is Nigeria's approach, because it's faced a lot of flack for people say, he's too much focused on the perpetrators rather than providing justice for the victim. But is that the way forward? Should we pursue restorative justice or punitive justice? Maybe that could be another approach. How do we reconcile victim justice with this kind of dynamics?
That's a great set of questions. And I think I'd even add one. I from what I've read in the press anyway, Ansaru reportedly, which is a splinter group off of Boko Haram, as I understand it, kidnapped almost 300 people from a school, not in 2014, but last month in Nigeria. So one of the things that you have to prioritize if you're the Nigerian government is winning, is stopping these crimes from continuing to be perpetrated, because the conflict isn't over. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I cite Safe Corridor in my chapter. And I note too that one of the interesting things about, or one of the interesting ways that it seems like de-radicalization programs like that may have played a role in the ICC's deliberations, is if you compare the statistics from one of the mass trials that the International Criminal Court uses in its report on what the Nigerian government is doing in prosecuting suspects with the U.S. State Department's statistics, on the other hand, it appears that the ICC may have been treating people who were diverted into de-radicalization, rehabilitation, and reintegration processes as acquittals. It really may be a little bit more complicated than that, and it may lead to a false picture of what the domestic authorities are achieving, because, look, acquittals are not necessarily a sign of a problem in the system, right? Some people will inevitably be acquitted. That is a sign of a system where the defense has a fair shot. However, if the ICC's statistics were taken at face value and Nigeria was losing, the prosecutors were losing 90%+ of the terrorism cases they were bringing against Boko Haram suspects, that would be a sign that they were doing something wrong. They were, they were picking the wrong people to charge. They were leading the wrong evidence. They were not doing a good job in court, something like that. If the great majority of those 90% that ICC has been treating as acquittals are in fact people who've been diverted into de-radicalization programs, then that's a very different kind of picture and leads us to ask other questions about the efficacy of the de-radicalization programs, which is maybe, you know, a little bit above my pay grade as a mere lawyer.
I agree with you, because some of the criticism we've had with the DDR program is, anyways, because I happen to interview some of the suspects in one of the prisons, and you know, you could see that some of these are kind of like low profile. So if you're doing DDR for people that are not core people, you're wondering if that is an effective policy to begin with. And some of these people that are enrolled in this program are not. And then again, you're looking at the stage of the conflict. At this point in time, it's more driven by criminality. It's more driven by things other than ideology. So how is that effective when people have tasted power? When is at a different stage now where ideology matters less? But I was going to come to the more serious cases that have been dealt in the court, which I believe is less than 1,000. I think I mentioned in my recent is about 600 or so that they've prosecuted. But we see that some of these things are shrouded in secrecy, or they could be like in the military court, or that those lack of transparency. So can the ICC use another approach? I recently had one of the editors of the book, your colleague Adeshola Adeboyejo, on the podcast, and she was saying to me the kind of like soft approach, you know, that ICC is doing on the continent in terms of like building capacity, building awareness, and all of that. So can it be a case where ICC can, you know, build the capacity of the justice or the courts in Nigeria, help them to be transparency and all that, rather than, can that be a more effective way of getting results?
Yeah, potentially. And you know, certainly when I wrote the chapter, ICC seemed to be saying, we're stepping away from that complementarity, capacity building soft, to use your term, model. But it may be that they're moving back towards it now, and that Niang's statement is an indication of that. In terms of the secrecy of the process, I think I'd distinguish between a couple of things, and I think ICC would too. You know, I think if you look at some of the international trials where witnesses face potential danger, potential threats based on their testimony, there will be evidence that, and identities of witnesses that are kept private for their own safety and security most commonly. But the court will make an effort to make its factual findings as public and transparent as possible, in part by issuing a document that is really only transparent for a small number of people like me, right? A 1,000-page long written judgment with 3,000 footnotes that a small number of people interested in writing about the situation will actually read. But also by, you know, publicly explaining the reasons for its decision and having that be viewable in the situation country. And it might be that there are ways that that the international courts have tried to, let's say, balance transparency and security, that they can provide expertise on. Now, that's not to suggest that the international courts have done a perfect job of it or anything like that. Just to say that, you know, they have some experience thinking about it, and maybe it's something that a situation country like Nigeria can benefit from as well.
There's something iconic you said in your conclusion. You said, let me see if I can repeat that. You said, I might not get it, I might be paraphrasing. You said the court's next step in Nigeria will have implications for its relationship with African states and African Union. Do you want to expand on that or that?
Yeah, and I think my view is this is a really interesting situation for a few reasons. In terms of how it shapes relations with the African Union, it's what you brought up earlier, that, you know, Nigeria has been a staunch supporter of the court at a time when its relationship with the continent has been sometimes difficult. And managing that relationship in a context where At least in response to Prosecutor Bensouda's initial announcement, the government of Nigeria struck a different tone than it had been striking earlier in the preliminary examination. Managing that relationship is important to the court because Nigeria is very important to Africa. And if that relationship were to go very far south, or if that relationship were to go badly wrong as a result of how the investigation progressed, if it did move forward to an investigation, I think that would spur further discussion, controversy, calls for potential withdrawal or reevaluation of the relationship with the court among Nigeria and its allies. And it, you know, I think it also, as I say in the conclusion, because there is this ongoing process in Nigeria where they've done some cases, and because of the long attempts at positive complementarity is the term the court uses for that soft stuff, when they're essentially trying to induce a state to decide that it's willing and able to do cases and to go first, rather than simply observing, okay, they're already doing it, we can stand down. It'll be, I think, informative for how that transpires in the future as well, and for how they assess gravity, because and how they're able, as the IER has called for, to focus resources on what seems like the most serious situations if they do move forward. Because this is, again, just based on the court's own gravity standards, the allegations here are very serious. They merit, if the court does the investigation itself, they merit the court's focused attention. They merit resources. And after a long wait, if the court were to move to an investigation stage, and it would have to, the Office of the Prosecutor anyway, would have to throw itself into it and really dedicate itself to getting some measure of justice. Otherwise, it's likely that they wouldn't be able to do so.
It's like, but let me ask you the last question, and I'm not asking you to prescribe anything, but to just, you know, to look at the, what do you think is going to be the future of ICC? More generally speaking, and specifically in Africa, and then how can it become more effective in this case?
I think ICC has a really hard job. I think ICC has a very finite amount of resources and is asked to do, by a variety of stakeholders, a whole lot of different things. And as a result, is maybe pulled in a lot of directions and hasn't perfectly found a lane. So it's not doing a ton of cases. Positive complementarity is not happening very quickly in situations where you might want it to. And so it hasn't found a perfect niche. That said, again, I'm conscious this is a really big job. The ad hoc tribunals had decades to build expertise on the perpetrator groups in a particular situation country and understand the functioning of the Khmer Rouge and the key evidence about it, or the Vojska Republika Srpska, the Bosnian Serb army, or the Interahamwe in Rwanda, in a way that, you know, the ICC is not able to throw all of its resources into any situation country because it has so many of them. I think for its future, probably the most valuable thing is to show some results. They've achieved, after a couple of years without one, convictions in a couple of contested trials over the last 2 or 3 years in Ntaganda and Anguin. And that suggests that if you're somebody who supports them trying cases, they're able to do it, which I think there'd been questions about a couple of years earlier. But if they're going to have a strong future, it has to be based on measurable successes that build state support, that tell states, you know, this is an institution that you can rely on to meet some of these important goals. And if they're not able to show measurable successes, either through success in the courtroom or through spurring domestic processes that are globally supported, accepted, treated as legitimate, and that the ICC gets some credit for, then I think their future is in question.
Look, Otto, I'm really, once again, I'm really grateful for your time, for your very, very useful insight into this important conversation. Like Riley said, it's one that's taken perhaps the longest of ICC's preliminary investigation and still in limbo. So I think this is a very, very useful useful topic. And we're so happy to have you join us today. And we'll keep you posted when it's published. And I look forward to maybe one day bring you again to come and talk, speak on whether an investigation has happened or what, however it progresses, to come and do an assessment.
I'll look forward to that. Thanks for having me. It's, the subject matter is not the most pleasant and the conduct isn't the most honorable, but it's been a pleasure and an honor to be here with you. So thanks for having me.
Right. You have a very great morning over there.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Bye. Thank you everyone for tuning in once again to another exciting episode where we've just interviewed Otto Traudy, international lawyer, speaking about the prolonged ICC inquiry into Boko Haram Nigeria. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I do, and I encourage you to join us again next week. For now, remain blessed and I see you. Thank you.